but isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15-1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label we cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Only weeks after he said the UK economy might have turned a corner, this announcement by the Bank of England's governor.
But let me be clear, inflation remains too high, and it's our job to get it all the way down to the 2% target and have it stay there. And this is why today we've increased bank rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.5%.
Since it took measures to tackle the pace of price rises in the UK, the bank has now raised interest rates multiple times, raising questions among economists such as Professor Keith Pilbeam about the efficacy of the move.
Well, today's interest rate rise is just another indication of the failure of the Bank of England to do its job earlier. And had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed to even higher rates down the road. And certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks doubled compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Sai Puriza, London.
Italy's top officials reiterated Rome's full support for Kiev during Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's one-day visit to the Italian capital. On Saturday, meetings between Zelensky and Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni took place amid heightened security measures across the city center, including a no-fly zone ordered for Rome's skies and police snipers strategically placed on high buildings. Zelensky received pledges of open-ended continued military and financial support by Italy's government.
We are betting on Ukraine's victory. I reiterated to my friend Volodymyr Zelensky that Italy will continue to back his country for as long as necessary. Also, we acknowledge and support Kyiv's European Union ambitions.
Since the war began 15 months ago, Italy has provided over 1 billion euros in financial and military aid, including the costly SAMP-T air defense system, which has for itself a value of around 800 million euros. This, despite polls have been showing for about a year that more than half of the Italians are against sending weapons to Kyiv, and tens of anti-war protests have been staged across the country. After meeting Italy's top officials, Zelensky held talks with Pope Francis. The Holy See has repeatedly offered its readiness to act as a peacemaker in the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. According to some analysts, the Vatican taking the role of mediator is an option that upsets chancelleries of many Western states.
Western chancelleries' opposition to the Vatican working for peace in Ukraine is paradoxical and contradictory. Paradoxical because a ceasefire would be beneficial for all the parties involved, and contradictory because key Chinese diplomats will start touring Europe on Monday. And my feeling is that Western governments will be more inclined to accept China's mediation on the Ukraine crisis rather than that of Pope Francis.
The Vatican is reportedly involved in a behind-the-scenes peace mission, but so far no details have been disclosed. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has confirmed such an initiative. Earlier this week, Pope Francis met with Russia's outgoing ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdeyev. Some Italian media have reported that the envoy may have been given a letter for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, ordering his immediate release and asking the government to ensure his security. The court also urged the ex-premier to condemn the violent protests and emphasized that court's primary responsibility is to protect the citizens of the country. The country's top judge in his short verdict said that Khan would be kept in the police headquarters till his next appearance before the High Court on Friday over safety concerns. Khan was arrested by Pakistan's security forces on Tuesday over corruption allegations. The ruling Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz has criticized the country's Supreme Court for setting Imran Khan free, calling him a criminal.
The Supreme Court has double standards toward the government and Imran Khan. It has ruled that Khan, who is accused of corruption, should be provided with all facilities and be able to meet people freely. It would send a message that the courts are willing to compromise on justice. My only question is why the court has double standard.
The angry supporters of Imran Khan welcomed the Supreme Court decision, saying the release of their leader actually upholds the rule of law in the country.
Supreme Court of Pakistan ka shukr ada.
We are thankful to the Supreme Court for releasing Imran Khan from illegal detention by the government. The recent verdict of the top court will be considered as the supremacy of the rule of law in the country, which was violated by the current regime.
After being released by the court, the former PM expressed his grievances about his arrest, stating that he was abducted illegally and tortured during custody. Khan urged followers of his party to end their protests and refrain from damaging public and private property. Pakistan remains in the grip of deadly violence and protests after the arrest of the ex-premier.
Although the former Pakistani premier can now breathe a sigh of relief following the top court's decision, experts believe that Imran Khan has to prepare himself for more political challenges in coming days. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
If
fourth Tehran International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital. Some 2,700 domestic publishers and 100 foreign publishers from over 40 countries have attended this fair this year. The motto of this year's book fair is "The future is worth reading." The international section of the fair aims to introduce the capacities of the publishing industry of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to expand cultural exchanges in the international scene, to lay the groundwork for communication between Iranian and foreign publishers. For the first time, bookstore owners can participate in the exhibition, and 200 have registered to compete with publishers in the virtual exhibition.
As you know, that Tehran Book Fair, one of the most important book fairs, that's Oman, Sultanate of Oman, that's need, that should be that participate. You know, as you know, that's more that's visit to the book fair. And as you know, that's one of the most important, that's to participate. The relationship between Oman and Iran, that's most important and large. So that's from many years, that's about the relations.
For the second time, a virtual exhibition has also been launched to make books available to book enthusiasts. As usual, the books are available to the public at a discount. The rate of discount is 10% for the virtual exhibition and can be as high as 20% if you visit the fair in person.
The Tehran Book Fair provides a good opportunity for international visitors, book lovers, publishers, distributors, and retailers to meet and do business and at the same time exchange culture during the 10-day event. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th, what this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maarouf from Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria, who was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, all we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League. It's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and in almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran, the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria? And why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they actually decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly, were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting. Now we're seeing the Arab world led, particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to. by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure from Afghanistan through Ukraine and their China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League and, for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States pushed on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved, as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vessel states like the Saudi country, Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates, or others that are normalizing with Syria right now, will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely. They're losing its grip. As the previous speaker just said, the United States' push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies and restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. And that's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization, because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel. To weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go, and it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be an enemy.
Interesting. So, Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait, and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead. That there is a struggle between the petrol superpower, Saudi Arabia, and the gas superpower, Qatar. And at the moment, the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States, and it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria, and all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us, what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria, in multiple times over the last 20 somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq, has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened, even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important also significance for Iran to show, this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And there's a steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah and some of the Palestinian groups. And they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran. Without Iran, Syria would have fallen by 2014 or earlier. This on the part of the United States, Syria was always, the war against Syria by America was always just a prelude to and part of the war against Iran. It was a way primarily to weaken Iran, ready for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Leith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
In the limelight.
Western brands are disappearing from Russian malls. Calculations show that the share of foreign products has dropped by half since late 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the presence of foreign brands in Moscow's largest shopping centers has dropped significantly over the past year amid an exit of Western companies from the Russian market, according to data shared by consultancy firm Nico Lears. According to the company's calculations, at the end of the first quarter of 2023, the share of foreign brands in Moscow's 12 largest shopping malls was 35.9%. That figure is almost half than in the fourth quarter of 2021, prior to the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine and the Western sanctions that followed. Analysts noted that the spaces previously owned by foreign brands have been actively occupied by Russian retailers, both long-established and those that bought out the businesses of departing companies.
Meanwhile, new foreign brands from Turkey and other friendly nations have also boosted their presence in Russia. According to Nicolier's estimates, since the beginning of 2022, 56 such companies have announced their intention to launch businesses in the country. 10 of them have already opened stores in Russia, and 5 are in the final stages of launching. Analysts noted that 64% of these brands are Turkish. Anna Nikandrova, a partner at Nicolier's, stated that Russia remains an interesting market for foreign brands opening their first stores both in Moscow and other regions. We are already witnessing a good pace of new projects opening in quality shopping centers, and we expect that by the end of the year, this dynamic will continue. At the same time, it is worth noting the high activity on the part of Russian brands, which last year embraced the additional opportunities which opened for them. She added, a number of retailers with ambitious strategies received the opportunity to implement them in the current situation, and a number of other companies in turn adjusted their development plans towards a more rapid expansion. According to data from the Kiev School of Economics, KSE Leave Russia project, out of 3,157 foreign firms that operated in Russia prior to the start of the conflict, only 215 have so far exited the market, which is less than 7%. Russian authorities, meanwhile, have been actively reorienting both imports and exports from Western countries and companies to new markets and introducing other trade mechanisms to help keep the domestic market well stocked. According to Reuters, in February, President Vladimir Putin waved a sarcastic farewell to foreign businesses which have left Russia over the conflict in Ukraine, saying their departure would benefit Russian companies. Speaking to senior officials at a meeting broadcast on state television, Putin said those companies had suffered major losses as a result of exiting a large and lucrative market. Today, many of Western brands, under pressure from their governments, are leaving our market. All the best to them, he said, briefly waving his hand in a farewell gesture. Putin added, nothing in Russia has collapsed and nothing is falling apart. Our companies and entrepreneurs are picking up these enterprises and even entire sectors and continue this work very successfully. Scores of Western companies, from energy producers to food and clothing chains, have left Russia in the last year. Amid unprecedented sanctions imposed by Western countries, some departed firms have sold their assets to local investors for nominal fees. Western sanctions over the crisis have upended some sectors of Russia's economy, cutting its biggest banks from the SWIFT financial network, curbing its access to technology and restricting its ability to export oil. Moscow says its economy is resilient and that sanctions have boomeranged against the West by driving up inflation and energy prices. Putin also said recently that Russia should build a system for developing drones and aim to become a source of technology and competence. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
We'll be right back.